Hey everyone, welcome. I hope you're remaining happy, healthy, and indoors. For those of you who have not been following, we are doing a episode recap show of The Twilight Zone based on a list published by Vanity Fair a few years back when PL was rebooting it for CBS Interactive. But regardless, we have a good show here today. If you're wondering why there wasn't an episode last week, it's because we did something exclusively for Patreon. So if you're interested, check out Patreon, where we're going through the Alien movie series. And you'll get an extra there. And in the next couple of weeks, there'll be an extra Bond movie just for those people at the Bond tier. Thanks, guys. Stay indoors. So stay healthy and thanks.
Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone? Zone.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Twilight Zone Zone. I'm host Nick Hoffman, riffer on Cineprov, and we really are trying to figure out a way to do this 6 weeks in, of course. And on panel, we've got Matt.
Yep, the one and only.
And Daniel.
Hello, this is Daniel. You can find me on Popdos once a month. And right now, frankly, I'd love to hitchhike somewhere outside of my home.
Yeah, no kidding. So this week, we did two episodes. The Hitchhiker. And The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, episodes 16 and episodes 22 of the first season, respectively. My goodness, there's a lot of episodes in a season back in the 1950s and 60s.
Back when people had attention spans.
Actually, though, I'm going to argue with you there, Matt. I listened to an interview about this kind of stuff, and they said, actually, they were written like radio plays. That's why if you watch these, they describe what's happening on screen constantly because people treated this like a radio show where they would just kind of drift in and out. They wouldn't be watching the screen at all, actually.
Also, Matt, back then, reruns weren't really a thing. So they kept making new content because they couldn't lean on old content.
And that's why you have like the Twilight Zone being 36 episodes long. And then halfway through the season, they would like try to do a spinoff almost within the same show. But whatever, it is what it is. The first episode we're talking about is The Hitchhiker, and like usual, I will do the opening narration. Her name is Nan Adams. She's 27 years old. Her occupation? Buyer at a New York department store. At present on vacation, driving cross-country from Los Angeles, California, from Manhattan. Minor accident on Highway 11 in Pennsylvania. Perhaps to be filed away under accidents you walk away from. But from this moment on, Nan Adams' companion on this trip to California will be terror. Her route, fear. Her destination, quite unknown.
I love how back in the 50s, you could have a 27-year-old named Nan.
I was also going to say, I like the idea that as a professional woman, she has enough vacation time to drive across the country, presumably to then drive back and spend some time in LA at 27. So she has like a month of saved up vacation time or something.
Oh, well, being a buyer at a New York department store, you can write your ticket.
That's right. Anyway, so there's a couple incredible actors here, but as is tradition, Daniel, why don't you give us a plot synopsis of this episode?
Nan's on a cross country road trip and she gets in a minor accident on Route 11. Which, mm-hmm. Apparently she was going 65, which was a death sentence back then. So after that accident, she's being stalked by this Peter Lorre-looking hitchhiker guy. And no matter where she goes, he's always thumbing her for a ride. And she's trying to figure out who he is and get away from him.
Mm-hmm. And it's an episode narrated entirely by her. There's no Rod Serling.
Which is
at all.
Strange.
Yeah. Which is nice. It's kind of a cool, what am I trying to say? It's a nice change. It's a little bit different. She is played by a Swedish actress, which was all the style at the time, making her impossibly blonde, like super impossibly blonde. Her name is Inger Stevens. And she shows up in a couple classics as well. Hang 'em High, The Buccaneer, The Farmer's Daughter. And in The Farmer's Daughter, which is a TV show, she got some awards. Like, it's kind of before, you know, the Emmy Awards were really a thing. So she got, like, TV Guide Awards or something.
High honors.
You get what you can get.
That's right. She died fairly young, actually, in 1970 at the age of 35 from a drug overdose. In the meantime, she was the head of a organization to help special needs kids, which, of course, now has a completely un-PC name, the UCLA Neuropathic Institute for Retarded Children. But, you know, it's still nice that she did good work. But anyway, the other dude we should talk about, of course, is the hitchhiker who looks terrifying.
It's like Peter Lorre's non-union Mexican equivalent.
Yeah, his name is Leonard Strong. He also appears in a lot of Westerns because I guess that's all they made back then, including Shane, The Naked Jungle, Cult of the Cobra, and he played your generic Asian character in Get Smart, which is an incredible show if you have not seen it, because he looks vaguely Asian, I guess. I don't know. But he's a Mormon from Salt Lake City, which is why I guess he gets all his creepiness from.
Probably.
Yeah. So let's talk about the episode.
Well, have you ever seen Carnival of Souls?
I have seen Carnival of Souls. It's a pretty good
riff
track.
This is the exact same plot. It. Yeah. No, it doesn't. It's a Criterion movie, too.
It is.
This is the exact same plot in this as in that movie. So it was an interesting compare and contrast for the two. Carnival of Souls is definitely better made, and it's got a more interesting plot. But they're doing some interesting things here, too.
Though, if I recall correctly, isn't the twist at the beginning of Carnival of Souls?
They see the car accident, but she's shown walking away.
This came out 2 years before Carnival of Souls, almost right. 3 years. So, you know, once again, Rod Sterling being the most influential man in film. But yeah,
you
so
mean Rod
let's
Sterling,
talk about
right?
this. Yeah, Rod Sterling. What did I say?
You said Sterling. It's Serling. There's no T.
Oh, really? Oh, that's a shame. Yeah. This is also another one written by Rod Serling. We essentially, the open, the cold open, is her on the side of the road. She has like a flat tire on Route 11 in Pennsylvania.
Somebody's hoping to change it.
And the mechanic has the great line, which is you shouldn't have called for a mechanic. Somebody should have called for a hearse, which is just like, wow, thanks, guy. Awesome. Hey, awesome.
Thanks, Ryder. Now there's no twist.
That's right. Although it's funny because, like, despite all of that, I don't know if this would have been spoiled for me or not. After a while, it's pretty clear. I'm like, oh, the dude is the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, like, I didn't get that at all.
Oh, really?
No.
Anyway, well, that's great. Maybe it worked.
After that line, I'm like, okay, I see where you're going.
And I will say something else that makes this work, by the by, is the score. We haven't really talked about the music much in the show because the na 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 at the beginning is very, it's exactly what it sounds like, right? Like it's kind of almost a cliched, almost a trite piece of music at the beginning. But the music throughout the show is also incredible. This episode in particular was written by Bernard Herrmann. And this is the radio, which is the same soundtrack from the radio version. This was a radio episode he had written that then he rewrote for the TV. Right. And
Bernard Herrmann wrote this?
This literally Bernard Herrmann. Yeah. I mean, that's what we're talking about. The guy who did Psycho, pretty much everything really good that Hitchcock did, like, is underscored. But so Citizen Kane and The Day the Earth Stood Still and, you know, Cape Fear and Taxi Driver, like Twilight Zone had him around. And that's why this is kind of so, like, hair raising. It's really quite good. And so, essentially, she pulls into the next town, goes to a gas station with a lube shop. He, you know, fixes the car up, fills the gas tank, and fixes the tire, which, you know, they have kind of a spare put on. And off the corner, we see this kind of drab man. Now, he was at the accident site and tried to get a hitch, but then just kind of magically appears miles into town, wearing this kind of dusty old fedora, kind of ragged jacket, and just thumbing a ride. He never says a word, right? at least not till the end.
That was also great, seeing that gas station where they're talking about how the tire cost $23.
I know.
A golden age.
I had the same thought. Yeah, I had the same thought. But yeah, so they're going along. Tension is building, blah, blah, blah. And every time she sees him, she becomes more unnerved. Like, he shows up again in Virginia. She shows up again near some railroad tracks. And her car stalls out as he sees her.
Isn't she trying to get away from him? And while she's doing that by driving over the tracks, that's when it stalls.
And then doesn't he appear on the other side of the tracks then?
I think
yeah,
so,
he's on
yeah.
the other side of the tracks.
Then it like the engine kicks in just in time to chug backwards and kind of launch her out of the way of the train. And then when the train goes by, he's gone.
Matt hit on something really interesting here. I think the use of her narration in this episode really works. Because you're right, this was a radio play, so that would have been necessary. But even over the images, her talking about her descent and her fear of this hitchhiker, it's really effective. I'm trying to find like some snippets of it.
It's funny. I guess you saw it, and I really haven't. It is reminiscent of the reviews of The New Invisible Man in some way, right? Because it's the ultimate fear of a woman, this idea that there's someone coming, no one believes you that you're in trouble, and there's this aggressive man after you, right?
Yeah, and then we have the sailor who he kind of comes off a bit inappropriate times, and then she starts scaring him.
So we should get there. Like, it's like the middle of the night and she's out of gas because I guess in a scene very much akin to Psycho, which would come out the same year, 1960?
Think it was a year later.
The woman is so manic at this point, she's essentially driven through the night and run out of gas. And this is not the era of, you know, nowadays where you can just kind of fill up on your own because it's all electronic. She has to find a gas attendant because everything's turned off. The pumps are turned down. And it's like 11:30 at night or whatever the guy says. And she can't get gas. And at this point, a sailor who's walking around the road for some reason, you know, kind of welcomes her and says, "Hey, we can, let me help." And he even shakes the door. He rattles the cage of the gas attendant who doesn't want to help so he can fill up. And she promises to drive him all the way to San Diego from, I think they're in New Mexico at this point.
Yeah, because he was trying to go back to his ship because he was on leave. So I get the vibe he was a hitchhiker himself because back then that was more common. Like my grandfather would hitchhike home from college.
Sure, totally. I think you're not only 100% right there, but we should talk about those vibes like you were talking about that he gives that kind of makes people uncomfortable. It's a very weird because he's, I don't know, he comes off like Channing Tatum in Hail Caesar. Like he's so bubbly and over the top that makes you suspicious immediately.
Well, the fact that he was friendly wasn't the problem. The problem is I think he got more and more pushy and rapey when they were in the car. And then when she starts losing her mind, then he starts freaking out.
Yeah, I get it. And I think you're right. Like, there is this kind of, like, weird sexual reversal which happens because he is so terrified. I get the feeling that her being uncomfortable and wanting, like, someone around makes sense. And he's like, "Hey, this is my lucky day." Makes sense. Kind of weird, but makes sense. But then when he realizes that she has a real threat, potentially, or maybe she's just crazy, I don't know. It is an interesting turn.
Well, he's telling her, you know, you don't need a boyfriend. You need a good night's sleep.
I don't know if he could get away with this sort of character today because, well, for one, it'd be considered very anti-feminist. But when you mentioned The Invisible Man, you're right. It's the same sort of fear. And the fact that the sailor isn't talking her down is what unnerves him because he feels like he's losing that power over her.
And I mean, I think the other thing about it, too, is it's not just the kind of threat of violence or whatever. It's a lot of shorthand. Like, I mean, this is the 1950s and early 60s. Who's more trustworthy than a soldier, I think, is kind of the idea. And because of that, what's the big idea kind of thing, I do think it's very interesting that then he is supposed to be this big, tough, masculine dude who's doing what's right for us in his country, and he chickens out, I think is also supposed to add to the fear, the paranoia, right? Like, it's a lot of writing shorthands. Much again, like an episode we'll get to soon, five characters in search of an exit. Like, it's literally just archetypes, or as Matt might say, tropes. Which, again, I think makes it effective. I think it makes it an interesting kind of dialogue filled with shorthand.
What do you think about the twist? I've already said what I think. Did it work for you?
I think it's fine. At this point, I kind of... Well, I mean, let's get to it, actually. In Arizona, I believe they are, she stops because she's essentially suffering a nervous breakdown at this point. And Nan calls her mother. The woman answers the phone. It's, I guess, the superintendent of the super of the apartment building she lives in. She goes, look, Miss Adams is in the hospital. She had a nervous breakdown after finding out her daughter Nan had died 6 days ago when she was driving a tire and her tire exploded and it overturned, blah, 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 blah. At this point, Nan realizes the truth, which is that she has never, or she didn't survive the accident in Pennsylvania, and that the hitchhiker is death itself, patiently and waiting for her to realize that she's been dead all along. And then she kind of goes almost flat affect and seems very Stepford Wives-y, gets into the car, death is in the back seat, and the hitchhiker
doesn't
finally gets
line. Doesn't she say something like,
I believe you're going my way.
Something? Yes.
Yeah, I believe you're going my way, which is fantastic.
Well, before that, in her narration, she's talking about how when she found out, she didn't feel sad, she just felt empty, like a shell or something.
That's what she says.
And you're right, that is a great final line.
Yeah. And so for me, I mean, now that we have the twist on the table, yeah, I think it's a fine twist. But like for me, about halfway through, I kind of got the feeling, and I don't know if it was because I probably have seen this episode before, or I just know what the show is. But no, I do think it's kind of an interesting, even if you don't know the twist, I think it works as like, it's a good twist, A, and two, it's a creepy, like, it's a good stalker story. Matt, you said you were kind of, you didn't see the twist coming.
I didn't see the twist coming, but I wasn't like, ugh, upon hearing it, you know, it wasn't that much.
So you didn't have a loud orgasm upon
the... No, I wasn't like, whoa, like, impressed or shocked. It was like, okay. I mean, it was, I mean, I thought this episode was kind of meh.
Fair enough. Daniel, what about you? Did you like the twist? What do you think?
I saw it like right at the beginning, and then as I realized, oh, Carnival of Souls copied this, I see where this is going. I like the final line, but I don't really think it was that shocking. I kind of agree with Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I think it had better, it had good lines, but otherwise it was kind of, I don't want to say indifferent, but it was fine. Like, it really was just fine. All right, so let's start the second episode. We'll be back with The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
So we're all back for part two. Our second episode today is The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, March 4th, 1960, episode 22, also written by Rod Sterling. Let's do the narration. Also written by Rod Sterling. Is there a person named Rod Sterling that I'm making up? Whatever. Rod Sterling.
Might be that guy who let everyone think he was the Twilight Zone guy in order to pick up women at bars.
That's funny.
Like, kind there's of, a kind of like how Bob writer who calls himself Stephen R. King.
All right. So opening narration, Maple Street, USA. Late summer. A tree-lined little world of front porch, gliders, barbecues, and the laughter of children, and the bell of the ice cream vendor. At the sound of the roar and the flash of light, it will be precisely 6:30 p.m. on Maple Street. This is Maple Street on late Saturday afternoon. Maple Street in the last calm and reflective moment before the monsters came. Even reading that narration, it's such a perfect Twilight Zone setup. You can feel a tingle run down your spine when he opens it because, again, it's the little ticky-tacky houses of the man in the gray flannel suit of the suburbs. Like, it's really fantastic.
This is Cold War paranoia at its best.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, except they're afraid of aliens and not communists.
What's the difference? Which is kind of the same. Yeah.
Which the only reason they have the idea of aliens in the first place, that kid is like, there are aliens in my comic book.
That's right. Well,
yeah.
I mean, Matt, this whole thing could have been avoided if they didn't trust an overly imaginative middle schooler.
Hey, that's the same thing they used in Back to the Future, and look what happened.
That's where McCarthy got his list.
That's right. I have here the list of 2,600 subscribers to a comic book. Anyway, Matt, can you give us the plot synopsis, please?
Okay, it's a nice, normal afternoon in 50s suburbia, and then there's a whooshing sound. People see a comet. All of a sudden, the electricity doesn't work. The cars don't work. No one can get a signal on the radio or the phone. And one guy decides he's going to go off to downtown to the police station, because surely the police will know what to do. And the people who stayed behind in Maple Street all go crazy, basically.
Yeah.
And in particular, there's this jackass named Charlie who wears a Hawaiian shirt, and he makes everything worse.
He does, including committing first-degree murder, which is great. Yeah, which kind of comes out of nowhere, because, I mean, yeah, there's occasionally violence in these things, but people don't usually get shot. I was kind of like, oh, it's this episode. Let's get into it. This episode is a classic, and I guess we'll talk about what I was about to say in the end. So what are your thoughts? Let's kind of go through this. It's got a great cast. We've got some strong-armed guys. A guy who I thought was Andy Griffith for a while, but wasn't.
Nobody really stands out to me. Apparently, the uniforms, though, that at the end are from Forbidden Planet.
Oh, that would make sense. Okay, so let's get through this. The family, or I guess the town, has some, you know, kind of various people in it. You have the strong chinned grizzled guy who'd be the hero in any other sci-fi movie, played by an actor, where'd he go, called Claude Atkins is the guy with the dark hair, the black hair, the grizzled face. He's also from Georgia, and he was in the show PJ and the Bear and The Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo. So there you go. You have the tall, thin, skinny guy who would play who looks like the alien from The Day the Earth Stood Still, the guy with the blonde guy. That's Barry Atwater. You have the Hawaiian shirt guy, who's Jack Weinstein from Cleveland, Ohio. He goes by Jack Weston because the other name was a little Jewy for the 1950s, I guess, and he decided to go by Jack Weston. This episode is kind of predicated on a power outage and then almost turns into the Salem witch trials.
I'm saying they go straight to lynch mob and probably in real time a couple of hours.
And things start to screw with them almost immediately, because at first, things like the cars won't start as well. And they think, well, it can't just be the electrical lines because cars aren't starting as well. And then all of a sudden, one dude's car starts and everyone turns on him. And I think it's at that point that the kid goes, I've read about this. This is aliens. And though I agree with Matt that it's kind of a precocious, weird jump, I have been rewatching The X-Files, and if you can't buy stupid, weird jumps like that, that show doesn't work either, which is funny.
I think the kid brings up the saucer men stuff before the car starts turning back on.
That's fair. I think you're right, actually. I think you are right.
Because if someone isn't affected, then you start thinking he's a Soviet spy or an alien or whatever. But until then, they had no idea who was who or what was what. It was just, oh, our cars don't start.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but they initially dismissed the kid as a crank until the car restarts by itself.
I think you're right.
And then they're asking, hey, kid, what happens next?
And I think, Matt, I'm not going to disagree with you because I think you nailed it. You're right. But I think it's done on purpose that they don't say Soviets, because it's so obviously about Soviet paranoia in this, which came out like, what, just a couple of years after the McCarthy crisis. I think they're not saying Soviets on purpose. I think they're not saying communists on purpose, because that's the kind of thing that could still get you blacklisted.
One thing I thought would have been interesting, and I thought they were going to go this way, was what if it turned out that the only that the people they all thought were the monsters was like the only black family in the neighborhood. And this all was a commentary on white flight.
Now, that would have been very obvious, though.
The episode's kind of obvious as it stands.
I will say, stay tuned, because I'm almost positive that kind of comes up later. And it's also the plot of Night of the Living Dead.
There's no obvious minorities, be they racial or religious. Everyone is a nuclear family.
I don't know. The guy wearing a Hawaiian shirt might well be a minority, wearing a Hawaiian shirt and all.
A tackitarian?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This is also another one where the paranoia just kind of grows and grows and grows. The payoff, actually, I will argue that the end of it's kind of stupid, but we'll get there. After people essentially start noticing weird inconsistencies, things start to turn. Although, I will note that there's one thing we forgot that's kind of important. There's an old guy named Pete Van Horn, who's just kind of your friendly neighborhood guy who's helping people fix things. Like, I think where the cold open is him helping someone with an oil change.
Is he the guy with the hammer?
Yeah, he's the guy with the hammer in the painter's loop on his like dungarees. And he's like, look, I'll just walk to the next block over to see if they have the same problem or not. And to Matt's point, it spirals out of control so quickly that he almost becomes the villain in a Scooby-Doo. Like, we forget he's gone, but he's been introduced, so he'll become incredibly important in the second act.
Part of it at this point is just redoing the same points. Like, they start suspecting somebody's the monster. The Andy Griffith-looking guy is trying to keep everybody calm and saying, well, we can't do this, or we might as well set up a firing squad in the neighborhood. And slowly but surely, things get weirder. People's paranoia increases.
The scene I remember is there's more violent. The woman who I think is the wife of Hawaiian man starts saying, like, look, at night I've seen one of the residents, the tall blonde guy, walking around at night looking at the sky, like, which is a weird thing to say, like associating him with being an alien. And he's like, look, I have insomnia. I'm not doing anything weird. I just sometimes clear my head before so I can try to go back to sleep. Not at all questioning the fact that she was up all night watching him. Which is kind of the first thing I would have done, I guess.
You accuse so you don't get accused.
Which is Salem Witch Trials, right? I mean, Arthur Miller's play The Crucible must have come out almost the exact same time as this, right?
Around the same time.
Yeah. Oh, a few years before, actually. I think it says 1953. So, at this point, someone didn't steal from Rod Serling, I guess. We found one person.
There were like three original plots in existence anyway.
That's right. With that, I guess, in mind, they build and they build and they build. Ultimately, someone gets a gun because that's always a great idea in these circumstances. After wrestling for the gun and arguing over whether making a ham radio makes you an alien or not, which is a hell of a thing.
Yeah, they're like, who are you talking to?
I had the Wikipedia in front of me, and it's so funny because it just goes, the implication being that Steve is secretly talking to aliens. And I'm just like, no shit. Thanks, buddy.
Also known as the episode in which paranoia makes your IQ drop 20 points.
That's right. Which is, I guess, a line that they use in Men in Black, which I guess is a stay tuned. We've talked about doing Men in Black now for years.
Yeah, a person is smart. People are dumb.
That's exactly the line. Tommy Lee Jones sits down with Will Smith and says, I think, just exactly that. Yeah, like a fist fight breaks out. Charlie runs for the house. Everyone throws stones at him. And he grabs a shotgun, which is great. And they then...
Because Charlie was the one instigating against everyone else.
They flat out murder someone.
Yeah. I think I've got it all turned around. I believe Charlie's the one who shoots the gun, killing the figure who is Pete Van Horn, returning on a mission from Floral Street, which is apparently 3 hours away. I think he just went off to a bar and came back in the afternoon.
Yeah, drunken and it kills.
Yeah, it does.
They shoot him before they even get a good look at him. You'd think they'd wait till he got a little closer.
It's so funny that, like, then Charlie, who has now shot someone, is everyone's turned against him, and he immediately blames the child, which is great. He goes, it's your fault, kid. You're the only one who knew about the aliens. And I'm just like, guys, this is so stupid. And then you have a classic kind of end to a bad sci-fi thing. Lights start flashing on and off for no reason. It becomes The Exorcist or something. And then it just starts zooming out. And you just hear like windows smashing, people swearing, things flying around, ultimately ending with what I think almost undoes the whole episode. Aliens.
If they can turn off electricity and turn off cars, why are they using this power just to troll people?
Well, and that's literally what they say. They're like, huh, look what happens when there's only a couple hours without their appliances or whatever they said, something stupid like that. And you're just like, guys, this is just nothing.
I think I've mentioned this before about the 2002 revival. I think it gets underrated, or it doesn't get enough attention.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was talking about this off mic with Matt, and he had never even heard of it. Anyway, they remade this episode in that, mm-hmm. and I think they improved the ending.
If you want, just because I'm here, it's the 2002 revival. This came out in 2003. It was episode 32, and the narration was given by Forrest Whitaker. It also has Titus Welliver and Andrew McCarthy in it, too. That's pretty good. And it's about terrorism, of course, instead.
Because the
undertone is about terrorism. But the new opening and closing narration are a little bit different.
Plus the twist in the new one, it's the same plot that it was all a test. But instead of being aliens, which I think Neil already said was dumb, It's the U.S. military running a test on what happens when neighborhoods suspect terrorist activity in their town, and it's the same reaction. And instead of being this positive moment with the aliens, the army's just like, damn it, we've got another failure. Which I think drives the point home a lot more.
At this point, Rod Serling, you know, was probably not taking notes because he was on fire. And even still, this is a pretty good episode. What I almost would have wanted is, you know, the next morning power comes back on, everything's fine. There's a bunch of, you know, and the cops are just walking through and they say, what could have possibly happened? The power was only out for 8 hours or whatever. And that's it, right? Like, and then you give the ending narration, which I'll do here in a second.
That would have been good, especially if you see all like corpses of the neighbors.
Right, you know, people with guns, you know, like guns clenched in their hands, you know, huddled dead, children run like screaming. Hidden, like it's also pretty good. Anyway, the closing line is the tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs, explosions, and fallouts. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicions can destroy, and thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all its own. For the children and the children yet unborn, and the pity of it is that these things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone. Pretty good. Although, yep. Because Daniel brought it up, I will read the changed closing narration, one of the few things they changed in this episode, for the 2003 version. I can't do a Forrest Whitaker voice, I'm sorry. Because he just has kind of a warm bath of a honey voice, and I can't do it. It does. He has a very good voice, like a good kind of deep, which is why you hire him to do narration, right?
He was a very good narrator.
He was. It isn't enough for a sole voice of reason to exist. In this time of uncertainty, we are so sure that villains lurk around every corner that we will create them ourselves, even if we can't find them. For while fear may keep us vigilant, it also tears us apart. A fear that is sadly exists only too often outside the Twilight Zone. Pretty good. Pretty damn good. Anyway, so I guess it's tradition. Which of the two episodes do you think is better?
I didn't really think either of them were all that good. The monsters doing Maple Street, I think, was better because it kept my attention better.
Daniel?
I just think that's kind of funny. It holds my attention, so it's better. But you know what? Great yardstick. The monsters in doing Maple Street is much better. It's more of iconic. It's more important to the show. The Hitchhiker, I've seen that same story done better. It's certainly not a disaster, but if you really want to see what a Cold War paranoia was like, then you need to watch Monsters Are Due in Maple Street.
I'm torn, and I want to give compliment to The Hitchhiker because I do think it builds a proper tension. I do think good, but Monsters Are Due on Maple Street is exactly what I want from The Twilight Zone. I take points off for the ending. The list that we've been using, the Variety, gave this the I guess number one. This was its most important episode. It got its number one rating. I forget exactly how he puts it in the article. It will be in the description. Like it, for those of you who've been listening, I have been putting the description from his article as the kind of intro text to the episode. It was also, I think, Time Magazine's top 10, one of the top 10 as well. But I agree with you. I think it is still a great episode. I don't want to sell The Hitchhiker short, which was number 11 on his list. But I do think Monsters are better. So as usual, next week we will be back because this is never going to end. And we're going to watch two episodes, episode 28 of the season, A Nice Place to Visit, and episode number 34, The After Hours. For those of you who, of course, are listening just for The Twilight Zone, you should listen to our other episodes. We do kind of, not necessarily bad movies, but nostalgic movies we feel like we can actually talk about. We just released an episode on the 1989 movie, The Wizard. And this next week, we have a new episode coming out that I don't think we've decided yet. So stay tuned next week as we put more of the Twilight Zone on trial. Thanks, guys. The Twilight Zone is a production of Doodletter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, paneled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is Six Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Sterling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.